Did you guys ever talk about that sort of thing when you were together?
No, I don't think we got into death or...
Well, when he says forces of death, I tend to think, okay, he's talking about the spirit world there.
He's a very interesting character because he... I don't know what you'd call that, but he kind of denied everything. I mean, obviously, in that interview, he was acknowledging something there, but he did it in such a way that he could say it was metaphorical, like it could be meant metaphorically. So, like when he was asked if he believed in the things that the Muslims believe in, the spirits and all that, he said, "No, of course not. I can't believe in that stuff because ... because I was I'm a Westerner, right?" He didn't really mean, but on another occasion he'd say, "Yeah, I've been there and I've seen those people cut themselves and then they heal instantly." So I know he knew that the supernatural, what we would call the supernatural, was real. He'd seen it for himself. So it was like he allowed those two parts to coexist without trying to reconcile them or, turning it into a belief. "Well, I believe in this because I've seen it." He was an interesting case in that regard. I'm not sure what to make of that or of him, actually, like whether it was denial and fragmentation or whether it was some sort of wisdom.
You sparked something there with the him saying that it wasn't his culture, so he couldn't believe in it. I'm paraphrasing, of course, I'm not quite getting it. But a while back, I was listening to a lecture by Alan Watts, and he said that... he said exactly that you know, yoga, for instance, is not something that a Westerner should really get too deep in because it's not a part of our culture. He says the American way toward enlightenment is to isolate yourself to such an extreme degree that you end up realizing you need other people. But first you have to go to that extreme of, kind of isolation, maybe dissociation. He didn't use that word, of course, but, becoming singular, going into your ego in such a way that you come out the other side and you realize how important it is to be with others, to have a sense of community. And, I thought that was a beautiful thing.
So. Yeah, that's... that reminded me of something and now it's gone. But the thing about yoga is interesting because... Crowley's disciple, I think it was Gerald York, he was the main proponent in bringing yoga to the West, and Buddhism as well. Mm-hmm. Might not have been Gerald York, actually, I have to check that. But anyway, it was one of his main followers, which, of course, gives rise to suspicion. I do yoga, but one of the things I'm very... conscious of is that I'm not interested in any of the philosophical aspects. I'm just doing it purely for the physical benefits.
The body, yeah.
Yeah, I don't want to get into the... I mean, of course, I've become really leery of any kind of spiritual philosophies, right? But so it's partly that, but it's also that... I mean, I heard that from Jung as well, this idea that we can't just... graft on another cultural belief system onto our own because we're hardwired. Like culture is, Joseph Chilton Pierce talks about the war between culture and nature, and at a surface level, there's plenty of evidence for that because we live in a hideously anti-human kind of world. But at a deeper level, culture is an extension of nature. I mean, you can't get around that. Like, nature was there first, and now there's culture. So where did culture come from if not nature? Unless we're going to get into, interdimensional shape-shifting reptiles and whatnot.
Yeah,
but even
that's not there today.
That's not. Right. But even if we did, that's still part of greater nature. So we've got... It's like we carry around with this innate cultural proclivity or affinity. And I do think, yeah, something, I think, yeah, what reminded me of what you were saying was that something Paul Bowles said, which is that Arabs don't have an unconscious. Like, you can't do Freudian analysis on them because they just don't have an unconscious. And I think what he meant by that is that they're not, they don't have an ego in the same way we do. In other words, their unconscious is much more conscious, which doesn't mean they're enlightened, because you could say they're more animal-like. Of course, I get into trouble for that.
I have a hard time believing that particular.
It was certainly a very large and sweeping statement. Yeah, I mean, everyone has an unconscious in the strict sense, in terms of things they're not unconscious of, the things they're not conscious of. But this is Paul Bowles, so he must have been referring to something that he'd observed, right? And I can say I've observed something too about the Arabs when I was in Morocco, but it's difficult to put into words because you end up falling back on cliches like, oh, they're more primal, they're more instinctive, and so on and so forth.
Or maybe the cultural divide was just too great for you to see it. I don't know. I mean, it's kind of like saying, well, the Arabs don't dream. I mean, of course, that's absurd.
Yeah. But I guess what I would say, there's something there, is that they don't, or they didn't have the same sort of cultural conscious veneer, civilized veneer of behavior that we have. In the West, it's very clear, and it's the subject of countless movies, that the way we behave socially, on the surface, we maintain this civilized veneer of behavior. Underneath is a raging infant, you know, that just wants to fucking destroy everything in its rage, right? In its reach, rather. So that there's less of a clear divide there. Or at least that's what Bowles was saying. And certainly, I mean, maybe it's best not to talk about specific people, but you can imagine that the more primitive, the less civilized people were and the culture that they lived in, the less of a clear boundary there would be between their conscious selves and their unconscious lives.
Well, yeah, I'll give you that, I guess, but...
And so, but bringing it back to your point about yoga, that this the idea in the East that we have, at least, is that they don't have the egos developed to the extent that we have. So they believe in reincarnation and so on and so forth, and that they have this spiritual philosophy, or used to anyway, that they're, bringing it back to Buddhism, they're not really discrete identities at all. They're part of this great pool of awareness. So they're just naturally hardwired for that more passive, sort of submissive, worshipful kind of spiritual discipline or practice, whereas in the West we're going the other direction, you could say.
I don't know. Didn't we get the idea of ego transcendence from Buddhism and Hinduism? I mean, isn't that where it comes from? I mean, you know, you can't transcend something unless you know it exists in the first place, right?
So, but weren't you saying that we can't transcend the ego, we have to just go all the way into it?
I didn't say that. That's Alan Watts. And, you know, again, I'm not quoting him directly. I'm paraphrasing. Maybe you can look up the exact lecture. But, no, his attitude was that we have to go into the ego so far that we become isolated from the rest of society, and by going that deep into it, you come through on the other side and you realize how important people and community, you know, really are to you.
So that doesn't seem like the way of the East.
No, that is not the way of the East.
So that's my point, is that that their culture has never really lost that sense of being part of a community, and it's never really gone all the way. I mean, maybe it has now because it's become westernized, but as an Eastern culture, it's never really gone all the way into that belief in an isolated ego identity.
That extreme individualism, I guess, is he actually may have used that term, individualism, when he was talking about it.
It's characteristic of the West, and the will to power and occultism and all these things also. But I'd also say to intersect it with what we're talking about with writing and creating an identity, that And this has been my experience just currently, as I've just written this this piece that I'll be blogging as of tomorrow, and it's about film. It's a response to this writer, Greg Desola. Anyway, it was a big piece, like 15,000 words, and it took me about a week to write it, and it was very immersive. It's seen and not seen, like, in terms of examining my own patterns and so on. And but I noticed, and whether it's related or not, I can't be 100% sure, but I noticed that in the last couple of days, as in the time that I'd finished it, I'd kind of lost touch with the well-being that I've experienced since going to Finland, of just being much more in tune with my body and much more kind of in a body awareness space where there's just this innate sense of well-being. I kind of lost it.
Yeah, because you're sitting ignoring your body while you're writing.
Yeah, and because I'd gone really into my mind, and so I'd been reinforcing my identification with my mind.
Yeah. One of the great things I learned from Jungian analysis is my analyst, Lydia, early on pointed out to me that you've got to treat your body at least as good as you would treat a dog. You've got to exercise it, take it out for walks, you know, make sure you get the right food into it.
Yeah, well, I didn't stop doing any of these things, though, just interject, but carry on.
Okay. Well, for me, that was almost a revelation, because I had been so dissociated from my body, because I was a really extremely sickly child and severe asthma. You know, there were times where, you know, I really had a very difficult time breathing. You know, I was hospitalized multiple times when I was a kid. And so I learned very early on to dissociate, and that just became a natural way of being quite often. And so she was the one that brought me back to that sort of body consciousness, and it did do wonders for me. And, you know, I've heard you talk about the same sort of thing, you know, becoming more aware of your body and, you know, kind of residing in it a little more happily than you used to. And I do think there's some wisdom in that. But, you know, we all know that our bodies are eventually going to betray us at some point, and we're going to have to exit.
Yeah, well, I don't think that's relevant, though. Obviously it's relevant to us, but it's not relevant to the point you're making in terms of the fundamental value of being present in one's body. Mm-hmm. And I also, it was interestingly, was the initial impetus to put my attention there came from a Jungian analyst also. It's the same person who recommended Donald Cowshed, The Inner World of Trauma.
Yeah, I haven't read him yet, but sounds interesting.
So, and around that time, I mean, the context within which this analyst made this recommendation was all of the transcendental dreams I was having.
Mm-hmm.
Like, she was really struck by how profound and archetypal my dream life was. Including lucid dreaming and flying and all that, and she's just suggested, you know, try and put your attention more just on the mundane and on the body. She didn't want me to bring these big dreams to her, but also, you know, when I was dreaming and asleep, even she suggested that I try and direct my attention inward to the body rather than outward, you know, flying and into these cosmic realms and so on and so forth. And that was also the time that I became aware, and perhaps I told her this, I don't remember, that the more profound my dreams were, the worse I felt physically when I would wake in the morning. So I made that very clear correlation there between what you're describing as a child, you know, learning to dissociate from the body into these mental realms. Shouldn't necessarily call them fantasy, because they're not necessarily fantasy. You know, the mind can work out problems, it can write masterpieces, that's not exactly fantasy, but it's definitely abstract.
It is. I tend to think of them as sort of various Bardo realms, almost. And I do think that they teach you a lot, and I think part of the reason we feel exhausted after those, you know, quote-unquote big dreams, you know, the really intense lucid dreams, is we're working through things that are important there. And it's not always pleasant. You know, when I was younger, of course, like most kids, you know, I had dreams that dealt with, you know, terror in its various guises. And I don't have those sorts of dreams anymore, because I've learned that nothing in a dream is all that frightening. You know, I guess my unconscious has tried everything and, you know, there's nothing left that way. But now I find that a lot of my dreams work through extremes of emotion. And I'm being taught there, it seems, to learn to not respond with that kind of emotional vehemence or violence or however you would want to describe it, and to you know, be more accepting of things that on the surface, you know, seem incredibly upsetting. And, you know, so of course you're going to wake up from something like that and, you know, not feel great unless you've broken through and you've learned that, you know, those situations aren't going to trigger you at all. Mm. So, and I'm not quite there yet.
Yeah, I think that that's a valid qualifier. I think that it's not either or, but that my tendency for years and years was every time I'd feel crappy after cosmic dreams or whatever, I would explain it to myself in exactly the way that you did, and to some extent it was a rationalization because I'd left out the other side, that there's also this, you know, when we're not putting our awareness into our body, the body gets neglected, it's not being cared for, and we lose energy. And also if we're constantly zipping around the universe and not checking in with the body, like psychedelic drugs, there's an awful lot of, it's more than we can process, I guess. I think mm-hmm. the exhaustion relates to, that you're talking about and that I'm talking about, relates to accessing areas of the unconscious / trapped energy in the body that then needs to be processed and redistributed. And if we don't do it, then there's no gain there.
Right.
And if we don't do it, we get exhausted. See what I mean? Like it's finding that the balance between. I had this question, bringing it back to the point about this period writing, was like, is that really the case that I'm feeling kind of crappy because I did a really good job writing? That seems kind of sucky. Then my wife pointed out, well, maybe because you did a good job writing, just what you said really, then you access, you know, parts of yourself in your unconscious that you hadn't accessed before, and so that takes a while to process and it's going to be exhausting. So
yeah,
so I think
painful.
It's both, or painful, but so I think, yeah, it's both. I think that it's, for me, it's important to emphasize the negative in this case because I've de-emphasized it so much in the past. I completely kind of overruled that. Nah, this is all just Kundalini rising, or this is all just, you know, however bad I feel, it's something good is happening. To the point that, like many Christians and many spiritual seekers, I think that I more or less made a correlation between successful spiritual progress and suffering and discomfort and exhaustion. And I don't think that's right. I mean, that can't be right.
I think exhaustion, though, is a natural part of, you know, going through something that's difficult. I mean, certainly, you know, at the end of a hard work day, I come home feeling exhausted and kind of wrung out, and that's just the way things are. There's a famous quote from Carl Jung that I used in my book that relates to this, and it goes something like, "There's no coming to consciousness without pain. People will do anything, no matter how absurd, in order to avoid facing their own soul." And that you don't become enlightened by imagining figures of light, but by making the darkness conscious.
Well, I know all that stuff. I mean,
yeah,
you're preaching to the choir.
I know, we both do, obviously, yeah.
Yeah, but so, and I'm very, well, you did just quote Jung, so I can quote Dave O'Shana. I mean, there's no difference there, except I know him personally. Like, that wasn't his experience, or at least if it was, he's lying. Like he denies that there's any correlation between enlightenment and suffering and dark night of the soul and self-examination, all that. Now, I don't exactly believe him, or at least I know that's not the case for me. I know that a lot of the process is painful and so on and so forth. But I no longer trust this direct correlation, as in there's no way to attain enlightenment without going through all the shit and processing it and all that. Like, for me, it's just part of what I'm doing here, and I'm a writer, and I
right.
testify, and it does seem to be helpful to others. And so I'm not, don't get me wrong, I'm not like trying to invalidate or devalue my own path. Just this assumption I've had that you were reinforcing there, that is everywhere throughout the culture, whether it's Jung or whether it's Strieber or whether it's whoever, that we have to suffer and we have to, go through pain and anguish in order to become whole.
Well, there, that process of integration, I mean, you've seen it happen in your own life, right? I mean, certainly you must feel more integrated than you did 10 years
Well,
ago.
so here's the paradox, right? Because
Yeah.
I'm feel you know when it when I'm aware of being in touch with something that I was trying to get in touch with, which is well-being, joy, purpose and meaning, and all of that. On the one hand, yeah, I have to acknowledge this must be, to some extent, the result of all the work I've done. Like, it can't be completely unrelated,
Sure.
because I've been excavating all that stuff. But on the other hand, this is a paradox. When I'm in that space of well-being, what I recognize is that it was always there, and that there's nothing that could ever have got rid of it or removed it or taken it away from me, and that I never had to do anything to experience this, because it's just right there. It's under the skin. So that's such a paradox. I can't, the mind can't reconcile that paradox. I could just say, well, both are true. Like, for me, somehow I had to occupy my mind with all this excavation and stuff. Maybe it's karmic, maybe it was dharmic, maybe it was both, karma dharma. But it wasn't, it's not a causal thing. Like, this idea that there's a causal relationship between the work and the attainment, that is a mental, that's a flattening it out that over literalizes it. It's, I know that I just contradict myself, but there's no way
Yes, you did.
not to, there's no way not to contradict oneself when discovering that the thing that we're seeking and we've always been seeking for has always been there. Like,
Yeah.
that in itself is a contradiction,
Yeah, well, it's kind of like Keats's negative capability, the ability to hold two conflicting thoughts in your mind at the same time. I'll give you it, but if it's always there, but we can't access it, what good does it do us? I mean, you have to learn somehow to access that sense of joy or whatever you want to call it.
Hmm.
We all have foibles and neuroses that we would rather live without, and one way to do that is to kind of examine the wound, to get in touch with that shadow side, or however you want to phrase it. I, can definitely point to things in my life and say, yes, analysis and writing and examining these materials helped me to overcome things that were, in a way, crippling me. I feel much freer now than I did, before I started that whole process. So, for me, I mean, I would never tell anybody, oh, it's just there, go ahead and access it when you see somebody suffering. You've got to help them find a way to lessen their own suffering first.
You might like the light, but they don't like the sun. When the little people come, when the little people come, scatter shiny things, 'cause they're not scared of guns. When the little people come, when the little people come, better hide up all your pickles, better stock up on your rum. When the little people come, when the little people come, it won't be any fun. When the little people come, 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 when the little people step on the gas, better drive away fast. When the little people come, when the little people come, got something to say, save it for election day. When the little people come, when the little people come, just whatever you do, just don't get down on your knees. When the little people come, when the little people come, when you talk to the trees, put a good word in for me. Pretty, pretty, pretty trees, pretty, pretty, pretty trees. When the little people come, 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 when the little people come. I've been a bad man, but the shit is out of hand. When the little people come, when the little people come, we ain't another job for you. Depends on who you screw. When the little people come, when the little people come, bedbugs don't pay rent because they have a cent. When the little people come, when the little people come, the password will be mum. When the little people come, when the little people come, when the little people come, when the little people come. Try and make peace. They're unstable and they're fickle.
Well, I think what it has to do for me then with is recontextualizing the suffering, and that writing is a way to do that. Mm-hmm. I don't think it heals it or cures it or banishes it or anything like that, but it recontextualizes it. And I think I think maybe this is the conundrum, that is, there's a trap in that, because one can become fascinated by one's own suffering. And as raw material for writing, one can just constantly be looking for more, and or just constantly poking the wounds so that one can feel the pain and then testify to it. Yeah.
Well, yeah, but I think with writing, the beauty of it is once you get it down in a form that you're happy with, you can just set it aside and say, okay, I did that. I don't need to examine that story anymore. There's a this is going to go off track a little bit, but I have a whole long story I could tell you about Scientology. I was never a Scientologist really, but I kind of went into it from a journalistic perspective. Long story involving this guy named Xavier Deluc, who's a famous actor in Paris. But anyway, their idea of auditing kind of addresses that. They get you to tell a story of some trauma that happened to you in your childhood, and you have to keep repeating it while you're holding their little e-meter cans until they tell you, oh, well, you're not showing a reaction to that story anymore. Mm-hmm. And, if it's a very traumatic thing, of course, they make you run it out longer. It gets very boring. But I think maybe it works. I mean, certainly other people have said it works. And they use that up front. That's how they try to sucker people into Scientology, to get them pay for other courses and things. They use something useful up front, and then they use the the more bizarre stuff about thetans later.
Yeah, of course. Except now it's on South Park and everybody knows.
Yeah.
But my guess about that, and it's just now that you're saying it, because of course I'm going to want to shoot down any Scientology method, even if it's just a hook. But from what you described there, it sounds to me that could be more the reason that works temporarily is that you're mentalizing something. So if you create a mentalized version of the trauma, and then just keep referring to that, it's like they say about memories, every time you remember something, you're actually remembering the last time you remembered it, and so mm-hmm. the copy degrades over time. It sounds to me that could be that method, a conscious appliance of that principle, that if you just keep repeating the story, you're essentially dissociating further and further from it, rather than actually reliving it, which is the psychotherapeutic method, which is, and this, in my experience, sounds very different from Scientology, which is the opposite. The closer you get to the trauma, the worse it gets, until you're fully in the body trauma, and it's completely overwhelming, and you can't think about it at all, and it's just affect. It's pure affect, and then you're okay. Then it's clear, because it's a physical charge in the body that can only.
Yeah, you're talking about an ab reaction there. That definitely happens.
I think I've observed in people this thing. I think it's relevant to what we're talking about as well, like the double-edged sword of writing. How we can use writing to self-stim ourselves, like the Scientology thing, you just keep repeating it, but also to create a false version of the experience that we can then, we just relate to that instead of the actual trauma that's in the body.
I do think that, you know, whenever you recall anything, it is kind of a false version. You're never going to get everything back up the way it actually happened. So, I don't know what to say here. I find that both abreaction and kind of getting the narrative down are two different ways to accomplish the same goal, which is to get past the trauma. And in my life, I found both to be effective at various points.
So abreaction is a technical term for what I was describing?
Yeah, where you actually relive the event and experience all the motions again, and you know, you physically feel the same things you felt back then.
Yeah, so I would say they can work together, and they get, mm-hmm. We can only refer to our own experience and then extrapolate from that. Of course, if we're unwise, turn it into dogma, which is always tempting, but in my own experience, that the kind of narrating my experience backward to try and deduce memories or events and so on and so forth, that can work for directing the awareness, and I think that this is what the mind is good for, period, directing the awareness to the body. I think that that's what we can use our mind for, and most other things it's kind of obsolete. But anyway, if I write about my past and the possibility of trauma, and even other people's trauma, Whitley Strieber or whoever, then I'm unconsciously directing my attention, but by putting my mind on these subjects, my awareness is being drawn to the corresponding traumas in my own body. And then what happens, my experience, I'll have these nightmares or these dreams, and where I'm in the affect, and then it clears out. Mm-hmm. And then I might continue writing about that subject if I'm still halfway through, but it will be in a much clearer way, I suppose. Or maybe I wouldn't, I don't know. Like this last piece that I just wrote, it was prompted by a disagreement. Like, this guy has written these books and I really was impressed by it, and then it turned out that he thinks Taxi Driver is a bad movie, and he outlines why, and that caused such a strong reaction. I don't know if it was abreaction, but it caused a strong reaction in me, that I was actually kind of distressed for a period. It was like stirring up all this other stuff, so I had no choice. I felt like I had no choice but to address this. I'm going to have to set this guy straight. I'm going to have to resolve this tension between, you know, how is it that this intelligent guy could be so wrong about a movie, and so on and so forth, and why is it so important to me, obviously, is the real question.
That's the question I'd be asking.
That's the central question there. How is that? Why is that locking, you know, hitting some sort of pattern in myself,
right?
And so then I wrote the piece, and it did resolve the tension. Like, it doesn't bother me now, right? But it also well, I don't know, actually, but the original point here that got us started on this was that it seems as though it led to my awareness being much more confined to my mind than it had been previously. And so as a result of that, the last few days, my mind's been influencing my experience a lot more than it was previously, when I was feeling very relatively happy and content. Because, as I said, my mind's main job, when it doesn't have a problem to solve, like this essay, is to make me miserable. It just constantly reminds me of all the things that, all the ways in which I'm not quite enjoying myself, right?
Yeah.
And now I'm listening to it much more, and so it's working, it's succeeding, and I've lost this ability to enjoy myself.
Damn it.
Yeah. So that's meaningful in itself, is I'm becoming more aware of how the mind is this powerful influence that, unless it's trained, or unless we learn how to relate to it in such a way that we only listen to it when it's telling us something useful, then it's always going to pull us into its matrix of misery.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, maybe. I can't. I'd want to qualify that, but yeah. What I'm more interested, though, in right now is, you know, we've talked a lot about the kind of underlying psyops in movies, and don't you see that with Taxi Driver? I mean, you know, think about, you know, Kubrick and some of the other movies where you really do, you know, you've talked about the psyops you see in other movies. You don't see any of that in Scorsese's movies?
Well, I have to talk about specifics. So, okay. I mean, this is what I address in the piece. I mean, I don't address the possibility that Taxi Driver was made as a mind control artifact, because I don't get into that deep into paranoid awareness.
No, maybe not deliberately, but certainly, you know, it seems useful to me for kind of inciting violence in society and, you know, maybe some other themes. I mean, I remember that speech that Scorsese himself has in the back of the taxi, you know, in that movie. You know, that's a pretty nasty bit there.
Yeah, so it is, I mean, it is a conundrum, or it is a challenge to find a way to, for me, for example, to make clear why Clockwork Orange could be a psyop and why I don't think Taxi Driver can be, that isn't purely subjective and say, well, I like Taxi Driver and I don't like Clockwork Orange.
Right.
Obviously, I have to say why I like Taxi Driver in such a way that it's persuasive. And the bottom line for me is that with Clockwork Orange, I think that Kubrick was making a movie from a scientific point of view, from a very abstract philosophical point of view. I don't think he was trying to work out something in his own psyche. I think he was trying to see if he could make a movie that would impact individuals and society in a way that was profound, and he succeeded, and it caused copycat violence and so on and so forth. And this is without speculating as to whether he was actually, the movie was made as an MKUltra, you know, artifact, which I think it probably was. If we trace back Anthony Burgess and even Kubrick, they had affiliations that suggest to me that that movie was made as a psyop. But even without getting into that, just looking at the movie and Kubrick, I don't think you can make a very strong argument for that being a personal work by Kubrick, you know, that he was wrestling with his demons.
Now, he doesn't seem like the wrestling with his demons type, does he?
No, and the movie doesn't have that feeling. It's not, it doesn't generate empathy, it's not painful, it's not distressing, it's not, it's disturbing because it's so horrible, but it's not, it's no, there's no pathos in it. Whereas Taxi Driver was three men, Robert De Niro, was Schrader, first of all. He was in his 20s, jacking off to porn, driving around LA in a car, lonely as hell, really in an awful place in his life, and he wrote this script as a way to try and claw his way out of that pit, if that's true, if he wasn't an MK. And he could have, you know, he could have been programmed from an early age and not know it. So there's a large spectrum here. But
I think he was more likely like my friend Chris. And, you know, he just kind of took the cultural memes that had been handed to him and you know, went in a certain direction. And that direction was something that fit into.
True. Okay.
You know,
so you're getting into the soft programs. And so, I mean, all products of culture are going to be carrying the cultural memes. You're not going to get me arguing for anything being 100% benevolent that comes from culture, but where I would, where I do still stand by the movies that I love, such as Taxi Driver, is what I'm getting to. That so we got Schrader, then we got Scorsese, who Schrader picked. He's also wrestling with these same demons of his loneliness, of his inner violence, his inability to connect, and so on, his sense of alienation, the masculinity, you know, the distorted masculinity, the being no role models for to really express male sexuality that just doesn't come out in these awful twisted caricatures. That this whole, you know, snake pit, they were both wrestling with that, I believe. Then De Niro comes along, he's also a young man in his 30s, same, he's got these same, and the three psyches really intersect, and together they use the opportunity of making a film. Yeah, of course they want to be successful and all that, it's compromised, but there's definitely a primary element there, which is three psyches working together to resolve some hideous tension in themselves. They create an archetypal character, taxi driver, who speaks to me as a young man, lets me know that the Dirty Harry ideal of the violent hero is a lie. You know, at some deep level, I wanted to be Clint Eastwood, but I knew if I went that route, I'd end up like Travis.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, it was a sensitizing thing, not only, but so that's my criteria, right?
Yeah, no, I get that. I like that explanation. I mean, that kind of makes me think again about the humanness in Taxi Driver that you don't see in a lot of other movies.
Mm.
Yeah, that's great.
That's all what right. It is for me, and that those are the violent movies that I love. That they there's a raw humanity to the characters, whether it's Pike in Wild Bunch, Frank Booth in Blue Velvet, Travis Bickle. The pain that's at the core of those characters was at the core of the filmmakers, Peckinpah, Scorsese, David Lynch. They put their pain into those characters, and the violence of the characters was an expression of their pain. So although it could still be misused, because our culture, you know, is such
well,
that...
yeah, David Hinckley sure misused that one.
John Hinckley, yeah.
Yeah, you're right, right.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's a whole... Yeah, we can get into that as well, and my own view would be that MKUltra used Taxi Driver to program Hinckley, so clearly the CIA thought, yeah, this is a powerful movie, we can fuck someone up with it, right? Yeah. So, but does that mean the movie itself is... irresponsible, or does it just mean that any powerful work of art, Catcher in the Rye, can be used to fuck people up, which would kind of be inevitable, wouldn't it? Because if it's powerful to heal, then it's also going to be powerful to destroy.
Yeah, I'll give you that. Yeah. So, a little off topic, but related. What do you think about this new Tom Cruise movie that's coming out called American Made? Have you seen the advertisements for that?
Barry Seal, isn't it?
Yeah, Barry Seal, and the tagline on the posters. They just hit New York like a week ago, so I've been seeing it everywhere. The tagline is, "It's not a crime if you're doing it for the good guys." I mean, how fucking cynical is that?
Wow.
You know, so
what
yeah,
makes
they're taking
the good guys then.
Yeah, what makes the CIA the good guys? Exactly. Yeah, it's kind of appalling. I mean, it's
overt, at least. I mean, I'm all for overt.
Well,
propaganda,
yeah, it's
becoming
kind of
more overt.
Yeah, it's a sort of a limited hangout, definitely. You know, the thing about Doug Liman, I didn't know this until I looked into it, was that his father was the chief counsel for the Senate Iran-Contra hearings. So, I mean, he's our age. He grew up knowing about the whole Iran-Contra story firsthand.
Mm, right.
So, you know, it's interesting that he's making a movie now, and I guess it was delayed a year, probably, so it didn't influence the election. Because you know the Clintons were involved. They had to be.
Mm-hmm.
But
I was thinking about Mark Wahlberg recently as well, because he's become a CIA asset now. Like all the movies he does, obvious propaganda, pretty much. Maybe not all of them, but a lot of them.
Seems like it.
And yet he started out, he started out in a boys band, but as an actor,
right,
he started out really promising. And he did things like Three Kings, which seemed to be subversive, and I Heart Huckabees, which I'd say was subversive in a nice, light way.
Mm-hmm.
And it occurred to me that, and you can't say this about Tom Cruise, that, oh, that's probably SOP, really, is that if they want to, you know, they want an agent of propaganda in Hollywood, first of all, establish his career, obviously, as a movie star, but also as a trustworthy presence, like,
right,
give him some good subversive movies so we think, ah, he's a real actor, and then
he must be telling us the truth. And
yeah,
I'm sure they're going to spin the whole Barry Seal story and make it look like he was just a rogue that did things on his own, and he wasn't, you know, helping out the CIA with the drug running. Well, I don't know. Obviously, the movie's not out yet, so I can't tell you. But,
I wouldn't see anything with Tom Cruise in anyway. I mean, not on principle. I just can't bear to watch him, partly on principle.
It is beautiful.
But I can't watch movies that are, well, obvious propaganda is a short way of putting it, but you know, when they take on subjects that you just know are of too much importance not to be backed by the CIA and the Pentagon. Just because the subject matter alone, there's no way this is going to get made in any way as sort of independently.
Unless they approve it, yeah. So
yeah, and
so,
it's more than approval. As you say, Lyman is actually, he was probably working for the CIA before he became a filmmaker, let's say, to put it in really stark terms, as opposed to the CIA is constantly nudging filmmakers here and there and so on and so forth. But why wouldn't they also just have a stock company of agents who they train in terms of actual media output?
That argument can be made. I mean, you know, certainly we know that Anderson Cooper, you know, interned with the CIA, and there are plenty of others, I'm sure. So I don't know that much about Doug Liman, really. He did the Bourne Identity, I think. So there's a CIA connection for you.
Yeah.
Mind control. So.
Yeah.
It's an interesting bit of speculation that we'll probably never really know.
Oh, I don't know about that. I mean, there's a book just came out. I'm sure it's not completely, a revelation or anything, but. National Security Cinema by this Tom Alford guy.
Matt Alford. I know him. Actually, I did an illustration for that book. We write back and forth.
Oh.
So he actually reviewed my last book. That's how I met him. He wanted an early copy of it. So.
How about that? It's a small world.
Yeah, it is a very small world.
So you read that book then?
He said he was going to send me a copy, and he never did, so I haven't read it yet, but I'm going to get it online, and I'll read it.
That's quite a coincidence, because I just looked it up today. You're saying you have a picture in it.
I did do a picture. I can send it to you. I haven't seen the book, so I don't know if he used it. I know there is an article that they released when the book came out that used that photo that I did for them.
So there's a book that came out last year as well, Movies, Myth and the National Security State. I mean, it is becoming more covert sphere. It's becoming more widely recognized, let's say, they're not going to name names, because you can't name CIA agents. It's treason, right?
Right, yeah. Unless you're Dick Cheney or somebody and you want to just let it slip to the press.
But one thing that interests me here is the rationale behind it. Like, if you have an actor like, well, it doesn't matter, we don't have to name names, because it limits it. But if you have artists who are at least somewhat serious about the work they're doing, and they want to do good work, and presumably they have, well, maybe I shouldn't presume this, but as I say, if they have any sort of ethical standards at all, how do they rationalize being part of state propaganda?
They're doing it for the good guys. Didn't you register that tagline? Come on.
I know, but we have to assume a level of awareness beyond that from people who work for the CIA. They know they're not the good guys, or at least they know that if we knew the truth about them, nobody would think they were the good guys, right?
Right.
Surely they know that. So then, but they must think, they do think that the end justifies the means. They do think that what they're doing is justified. So I guess in that
either
sense,
that or they just want a paycheck. I mean, how many people work for the tobacco industry or big oil knowing that it's doing terrible things to the planet? They do it because they want to pay their bills sometimes, you know? I don't know. It would be nice if we could base everything on moral decisions and
my theory is that they believe that the truth is too big and too complex for us to understand.
Yeah, you want to start talking about the breakaway civilization? Is that where this is going?
No, I don't know where it's going. Just that general idea, which I think is a interesting and dangerous idea, because I think it's sourced in truth. I mean, the truth about the world situation, and the rationale behind the hideous state policies is so complex and so vast that actually I don't feel confident in saying with 100% authority that it's not justified. I got to make a face when I say that, because I don't personally believe that the means justify, or the ends justify means. I don't go along with that whole, you know, philosophical framework, because I don't think the end is more important than the means, personally. Like, what's the end, right? There is no end. So,
right.
But if you do adhere to any kind of end justifies means philosophy, like René Girard, he ended up believing that, you know, we're always on the verge of mimetic violence in which the whole human race could end up tearing itself apart now in our global village culture. So if the powers that be believe this, then it could be that they're saying, well, no, we have to, you know, bomb this country, and we have to torture these people, and we have to do all this, because the alternative is a global apocalypse in which everybody's ripping each other's throats out, right? And if they actually believe that, and maybe it's even true, then, you know, that's a very large context that you could see how that would justify, you know, as a rationalization.
Yeah, the grand rationalization. Yeah. I mean, with that sort of logic, of course, you can justify anything. You can go rape children, do whatever you want.
Yeah, exactly. Anything at all. If you're saying that this is the alternative, and these are the strategies that we've come up with, and the principles we're going to apply to prevent that, and they're doing it in this very scientific fashion. Yeah, we've got to rape so many children, we've got to bomb so many, you know, whatever. However they do just purely kind of scientific.
Yeah, we've got to finance this whole thing with drugs, Well, it seems like the CIA is pretty expert in that. I mean, certainly they started early with Alan Dulles, and they've just been on a tear ever since. So, who knows, you know, it's like, I like reading Joseph Farrell and his thoughts about the breakaway civilization and how they're using all this drug money to finance something that, we just can't get our minds around. You know, they're looting the economy, basically, because they need it for what? We don't know. You know, maybe to battle, you know, some extraterrestrial race or something, for all we know. You know,
well,
it could
be anything. What they would like us to believe,
Barry Seal was flying in just huge bales of money to Area 51?
No.
Yeah, that was, you know, remember the plane that crashed? I can't remember the name of that. That wasn't Seal, but that was his plane, and there was a flight log in there, and they saw that this is the part I hate about talking about something rather than being able to write about it, because I could get all the facts for you and lay it down, but I can't even remember where the plane crashed exactly. Let's say Nicaragua. Okay, so it went down there. The Nicaraguan authorities confiscated the flight log from that plane, and they read it aloud in the media, or, you know, they broadcast parts of it, and supposedly that plane was, you know, taking the money that you know, it made after the drug transactions went down, and taking it to Area 51. That was the drop off point, among other places probably. But, you know, it's like, what was Area 51 doing with those millions and millions of dollars?
Well, possibly MKUltra.
Because
that's
maybe,
more likely what Area 51 is, in my view. It's a cover for MKUltra. I mean, the whole alien thing. So then...
Could be,
I did start speculating about this recently. Maybe the black budget, all these billions of dollars that the paranoids believe is going into the space, and even what is publicly said to be going into space colonization, maybe that's all a cover, and actually those billions are going into a massive MK Ultra program, you
could
know,
be
worldwide. I mean, just as a speculation in terms of how widespread it could be, the psychic driving and all the rest of it. And how much technology and manpower it would require to stay covert. But anyway.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, really both Farrell and Catherine Austin Fitz have made some interesting speculations in that direction. And Catherine Austin Fitz is really good because she tries to get the numbers down. She's the former Secretary of Housing.
Yeah.
She will talk in terms of, you know, how many trillions that were scammed, you know, during 2008. She calls that year the financial coup d'etat. And she thinks, you know, they basically have enough money to set up their own world government and run things from there at this point.
But what does that mean? I mean,
what does that mean? Well, yeah. That's the thing. That's nobody knows for sure. You know, so, you know, definitely trillions disappeared from our economy. They went somewhere and nobody can really track it. And so Farrell thinks, you know, it went into this breakaway civilization that is holding on to technology that is far in advance of the technology that, you know, we actually have right now. And
so does he think that there's another civilization somewhere hidden on the Earth or in the solar system where they're partying it up with great technology and great entertainment and perfect health care and all the rest of it?
Well, the perfect health care thing? Yeah, probably. Yeah. I mean, that's the thing. I mean, you know, the alien question is something else entirely, but he does believe that, you know, you should just get him on your show and talk to him about it, but he does believe that there is a small group of people that have access to technology that the rest of the world just doesn't have. And, you know, they're so far in advance of us that they can kind of manipulate the rest of the planet using that technology.
But does he think this is a new thing?
I think he dates it back to at least the 40s. He thinks that, you know, the breakaway civilization started there, probably right around, you know, the denouement of World War II. So.
And the first flying saucers.
Well, they weren't the first, but certainly that upswing in modern UFO sightings started around 1947. So, yeah. So.
Well, it sounds highly speculative, but
it definitely
you
is.
Could write a novel about it. I'd read that.
I have, actually, the last one. Yeah.
Right on.
Yeah.
Is that out, that one?
Yeah, that's the Crash Gordon and the Illuminati Underground. I address a lot of those issues in that book. So, much more eloquently than I can talk about them here.
Well, it's a different, yeah, you're in a different medium.
Yeah, and it's not a medium that I'm used to. But I am enjoying this. Yeah, it's interesting to be able to talk to somebody that is probably as well-versed in these subjects as I am, if not more so.
Different areas, but mostly. Oh, I see Matthew Alford. I got his name wrong, didn't I?
Yeah.
He reviewed your book.
Yeah.
He called you the conspiracy world's Nick Cave.
He did. I thought that was a little over the top. But yeah, anyway, I appreciated it.
Yeah,
Yeah,
those comparisons, well, if you're lucky, they don't stick. I was, Adam Gorightly said I was the James Shelby Downard of the 21st century. And that, or rather, Aeolus was, I should say. So. That didn't stick either.
Well, yeah, good thing. But, you know, that would have been enough to get me to read your book if I hadn't read it already. I think I would have been interested. Yeah.
We didn't get into the joys of being a marginal writer.
No.
The end of my conversation with Darren Westland. I don't have a podcast for next week. I haven't spoken to anyone. However, there will be a live Liminal Easter meetup, a second so far, on Sunday the 1st of October at 10 a.m. Pacific Standard Time. It will be $10 US attendance fee. If you're interested, just send me an email to jason@horticulture.com. It's still in its experimental phases. It went very well last time, I felt. It is definitely taking up some of the time that would be going into creating the podcast, so it may well turn out, if it continues, that I will be alternating between recorded podcast conversations and live meetups, which I will probably make available, at least in some form and at some point, to regular listeners. So once again, if you're interested, email me at jason@horticulture.com or just send a payment via the PayPal option at the website or the blog, and it will be good to see you there. They're live video meetups, and although they're still finding their form, the last one was group interaction, alternating with myself talking, giving a lecture, so to speak, on various different things. Yeah. Anyone who does want to attend the live meetups, if you haven't already read Seen and Not Seen, I recommend it as a pretty useful primer in terms of the kind of explorations that will be going on in the meetups.